This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the U.S. military has spread its tentacles across the length and breadth of Africa, leading to millions of deaths in the Democratic Republic of Congo. But Margaret Kimberly says the Congressional Black Caucus hasn't said a peep about Washington's culpability in the slaughter. But first, in COBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America has written a primer explaining all you need to know about H.R. 40, the congressional legislation on reparations for the descendants of American slaves. It's been sponsored for the past 27 years by Detroit Congressman John Conyers. However, no sooner was the ink dry on the primer for H.R. 40 than Congressman Conyers announced that he is resigning his seat in the wake of sexual misconduct allegations. We spoke with one of the authors of the H.R. 40 primer, in COBRA Legislative Director Cam Howard.
H.R. 40 has been the legislative push, and it's been the only legislative push for reparations on the national level for over 27 years. There has not been any other legislation submitted or bill submitted on reparations in that time except for H.R. 40. That's one critical issue why we should be concerned about this bill, is because it is a national push to address the issue of reparations. Prior to January of this year, H.R. 40 has been known as a reparations study bill. It's a commission to study the institutions of enslavement, pre-colonial, post-colonial, and then also the period of Jim Crow segregation, the harms and injustices done. In January, the bill was revised. The National African American Reparations Commission, in which I'm a member of, under the leadership of Dr. Ron Daniels, listened to a appeal by NCOBRA. I was sitting on the commission as an NCOBRA member, that H.R. 40, as it was written, was pretty much obsolete. A lot of what it was designed to produce, the outcome, particularly whether or not there was continued harms and current living African descendants from the institutions of enslavement and Jim Crow segregation, were those harms evident or in existence? That's what the legislation was supposed to produce. But there has been tremendous research. There's been tremendous amounts of international and national declarations and protocols, and particularly the World Conference Against Racism, Durban Declaration Program of Action, that declared that there is a continuation of harms on people of African descent, not only in America, but globally. Anywhere where there's people of African descent, those people whose ancestors were trapped in the transatlantic slave system and subsequently in enslavement, all the descendants, living descendants, have a inherited harm that's evident in a wide array of areas. And so there was no need to come to that finding. That finding had already been established. And so we determined, the National African American Reparations Commission determined, that we would revise H.R. 40, submit it to Congressman Conyers, and then seek to have that revision pushed through the House. We sent that revision to Congressman Conyers. He adopted it with very minor changes and agreed to submit it. He submitted it in January 1st of 2017, and then had a symposium at the House to introduce it to some of the legislative aides. Well, it was sparsely attended, and today people are still referring to H.R. 40 as a study bill, which in fact today the revision is a remedy bill. And so we created the primer to establish what is different from the new H.R. 40 and the old H.R. 40, what the new H.R. 40 is designed to produce, the outcomes, what forms of reparations that the commission, if established, can look at. And we wanted all of various strata of our community to be on the same page when we talk about H.R. 40. And the fact that Conyers has been, removed from the House, that's where we're getting to seize the time from. We must seize this time now that the longstanding proponent of reparations in the Congress is no longer there, we must build on his legacy, not let his legacy die with this piece of legislation. So we're championing to seize the time, Monica.
Yes, because no other member of the Congressional Black Caucus has ever put forward a bill on reparations. Do you have any prospects in mind in terms of another sponsor?
Well, the way the bill sits now is that it's just sitting dormant in the House until one congressperson or group of congresspersons stand up and say, well, it has to be one, at least one, that comes up and say that I'm going to take ownership of this bill. I'm going to push it forward. It's just dormant, and it'll die at the end of this congressional session. So in COBRA, National African American Reparations Commission, and hashtag 40 Acres and More Reparations Strategy Group, there's a lot of interplay between members on all of these different bodies, Black is Back Coalition, Reparations Work Group. We're looking at getting a small team of representatives to adopt this bill, having one person say, okay, that go on the House floor and say that I'm going to sponsor this bill, but have a team actually be responsible for moving it. And it could be a biracial team, multiracial team. What we've done in COBRA, we're having our board meeting next week in D.C., and a few of us are going in early. We've scheduled meetings with legislative directors. We reached out to 9 congresspersons who we think would be ideal for forming a 4-member team, 4 out of the 9, hopefully. And we looked at 4 senators who we want to get a companion bill. And so we reached out to them and asked them to have meetings with us. We've got responses from 5 congresspersons and 2 senators, legislative aides. And we'll be meeting with them as well as the executive staff of the CBC next week to make our push and our thoughts known how we want to go forward with H.R. 40. So there's some excitement about not just having one, but a team of congresspersons to stand with us as we seize this time.
In terms of the question of whether there is ongoing harms to the descendants of slaves held by the United States, a question that you say is settled as embodied in the new form of the bill. If there is not ongoing harm, when did it end? 1865, 1965, 2005? When?
And that's another thing that's different, and we spell this out in our primer, is that the criminality didn't end after the Civil War. It didn't end after the end of Jim Crow and the creation of the Voters' Rights Bill and the civil rights legislation that was put forth in the 60s. The crimes, the injuries did not end. They continued. And so this bill also looks at post-Jim Crow. It looks at the criminal justice system, the mass incarceration. It looks at the ongoing terror by police. So it's not just confined to the crimes of 3 centuries ago or the crimes of the 1865 to 1965, Jim Crow. It looks at the ongoing crimes, and therefore it brings us to compacted harm that we've inherited genetically, socially, psychologically, but also the current trauma and injury economically, social, and political from the continuation of discrimination and what we consider still crimes against African humanity today.
The reparations movement is sometimes attacked from the left as being a distraction, the position being that if the white ruling class is never going to give up on reparations for Black Americans, the continual demand distracts from other projects that should be in play.
I disagree with that. I think that the reparations demand empowers all other social justice issues, because when you look at whatever we're facing as a people as a result of being in an oppressive state that America is, we have to take into consideration the historical foundation, the historical social structures that were put in place and that are held in place by a certain will by the people who are in power. And so you can't look at what's going on currently without looking at the history. And the history shows that these were intended actions to exploit and to oppress and to dominate and subjugate a people. And that if you're going to address the current manifestations, you also have to address the underlying structure from which they were established. And so when we bring the reparations issue to the current issues around housing, around education, around health, when we bring those issues, we can see the continuation, and it empowers the current push. And so we have the total exact opposite position of the left when they say it's a distraction. We think it's an empowerment. We think that they do a disservice to their own efforts if they do not link it to the historical foundation from which the current practices of this country rest.
Yes, reparations advocates say that reparations puts the ongoing oppression of Black people in the United States in perspective. And without that perspective, each harm is just an isolated incident.
We agree totally with that summation, Brother Glenn.
So in terms of this HR primer, does it address the contemporary questions about reparations?
It does. In fact, in revising it, we extended Movement for Black Lives an opportunity to contribute to the revision, and they were clear on raising the issue of the current injuries, the current issues that are being perpetrated against people of African descent, especially their generation. And so that is spelled out in the new H.R. 40, again, as it talks about current post-Jim Crow actions against African people, or crimes, what we call continued crimes against humanity. And so, yes, definitely it looks at what is going on currently and how we see that in a total package of repair, and what is necessary for there to be complete repair is to address these current manifestations of crimes against African humanity.
So you've been dealing with the Black Lives Matter folks on this issue. Are we seeing the building of a bigger coalition for reparations?
We are hopeful. When you say Black Lives Matter, we are not really engaged with Black Lives Matter. We understand that Black Lives Matter is one organization of the Movement for Black Lives, which is consistent of about 400 or so, several hundred organizations that are loosely tied in a coalition called Movement for Black Lives. And it is that movement, it is that body that we've been dealing with, particularly their policy table, which put out their 7-point platform, in which reparations is one. So we built with that body, not so much Black Lives Matter, but Movement for Black Lives. And one of the things that with our interaction, when I say our, I mean the National African American Reparations Commission and Movement for Black Lives, in our interaction together, we understand that they've determined they're going to focus on two of their 7 platform issues, and one of them will be reparations. And so we think that having this connection with the two bodies has led them to make that decision. And we're certainly hopeful and happy that they did so.
And what organizations are targeted for receipt of this H.R. 40 primer? Who should be reading it?
Well, like I said, we developed it for all strata of our community. Dr. Raymond Winbush has what he calls the GLASS model of reparations struggle, and it's an acronym for grassroots organizations, legislators, attorneys, scholars, and students. And so we're going to use that framework and begin to disseminate this primer electronically as well as in hard copy form around the country utilizing Dr. Winbush's model. So we'll be targeting grassroots organizations. Again, Movement for Black Lives is a coalition of grassroots organizations here in the city of Chicago. There are several coalitions. So whenever we can find a coalition in a particular city, we will reach out to them and try to disseminate them that way. Legislators, of course, we've already sent some to CBC members, but we'll be sending more. We'll be taking some with us to Washington when we go to meet with some of the CBC members on next week. We'll be making sure that they're available to state legislators. There are several attorneys that we know that are prominent in the reparations movement. Right now, there is a conference being held right now at Penn State, a law school on reparations as we speak. They have Sister Nkechi, Attorney Nkechi Taifa, a longtime member of NCOBRA, founder, member of NCOBRA, member of the National African Reparations Commission. She's speaking. Our Philadelphia co-chair is speaking, and past co-chair of our national organization of NCOBRA. He's speaking on that panel today. So we'll be giving them out to law schools, Black law schools, student groups in Chicago, the University of Chicago. We're meeting with the Black Law School student group. And so we'll be getting them out to attorneys as well as law students. We'll be getting them out to the Black student unions, so they'll be able to be clear on what H.R. 40 is and what H.R. 40 isn't. It's no longer just a study bill. Again, it is a remedy bill, and we should begin to speak in the same language across the country on that. And again, we're going to get into scholars. That's the last S. There are a lot of new scholarship that is being generated around reparations right now, and we want to make sure that those scholars who have a forward-leaning position on reparations have the correct knowledge around H.R. 40. So that's really who we've tailored the primer to serve the needs of all of these areas of our community.
That was Cam Howard of INCOBRA speaking from Chicago. Supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, rallied in Philadelphia, hopeful that a legal opening has developed that might lead to a reversal of his 1982 conviction in the death of a policeman. A Pennsylvania state court is looking into the behavior of Ronald Castile, a prosecutor who helped convict Mumia and then went on to become the same judge who rejected Mumia's appeal. Dr. Johanna Fernandez of the campaign to bring Mumia home explained the legal issues involved.
I just want to remind us that the issue that brought us here today, beyond our common humanity and our common struggle for a better world than against capitalism and imperialism, is the issue of Williams versus Pennsylvania. It's very simple. The Supreme Court ruled about 2 years ago in 2016 that you cannot be prosecutor and judge in the same case. They should have ruled on that judicial bias a million years ago. But this was the first time, or one of the first times, that the Supreme Court identified what it means when you say judicial bias. And they determined that you can't be prosecutor and judge in the same case. So that's the issue that will bring Mumia home, because if we win this issue, all of his appeals will be opened up again. But it's not just about Mumia. This is how they've gotten so many people in prison. So there are many, many other cases. And part of what the DA's office said is that they needed 60 days to establish a standard on how that office was going to handle Williams versus Pennsylvania. Okay, Mike Africa.
Man, this feels good. Yesterday, my dad called me and he said the parole board rejected my eligibility and gave me a 1 year hit. After hearing about the 15 year hit, you know, it doesn't lessen the feeling that I feel for my father, but it makes me realize that this is what Mumia's book was called, Long Distance Revolutionary.
That's right.
This thing is multi-generational, over and over. We have to keep this thing going. It feels like I've been seeing these faces for so many years. These faces are changing, that people are getting older, but people have passed down this. Say what? People have passed down this message and kept this revolution going.
Yes, sir.
And it's encouraging to see. And I'm seeing new faces. And I'm seeing younger faces. And I can feel the energy from people, the way Betty Davis spoke. Right? I mean, it's shockwaves going through me right now. You know, and I feel motivated, right? You know, John Africa talked about this system, and he talked about how those courts ain't nothing but slave processing houses.
That's right.
You know, and like, so what in this whole thing of Mumia's book called Long Distance Revolutionary, what we got to realize is that these judges, although they may appear to be a certain way, what we saw today seemed to be a step in the right direction, but these judges, these politicians are controlled by pressure. And if you take the pressure off, and the FOP come and put the pressure on, right, they're going to be swayed their way. So we got to keep the pressure on. So we're talking about Martin Luther King. We got to get out here and put the pressure on. We got to bring all that energy and push on and keep the pressure on.
That's right.
Because the system, they don't do anything in our favor. Donald Trump talking about Haiti and Africa, country, of any country. He's not fit. They had this cognitive test that this guy, you know, took. You know, I had a picture of the lion and the cow or whatever. I saw that same exact test on my six-year-old's testing scores. You know what I'm saying? Like, this man is not intellectually with it.
At all.
So, but because of pressure from these industrialists, he was placed in there anyway, regardless of the people and how we feel about it. So the pressure is what it takes. March 27th, be here, I'm gonna be here, I'm gonna tell everybody about being here, and we gotta get everybody here to keep the pressure on.
Right.
That's all I got.
The Move Nine are activists imprisoned since 1978 on charges related to the death of a Philadelphia cop. Mumia Abu-Jamal's brother, Kevin Cook, was also on hand at the rally.
I just want to come in and just tell you how pleased, how humble, how happy I am that I have this family supporting me as I wait for my brother to come home.
Yeah. That's right.
You know, I told you all too, that I'm gonna be to come home in my lifetime.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
In my lifetime.
Yes, sir.
Before they ask me how I'm doing, maybe that's where Mamie gets it from. He says, like, you know, I say, I'm all right. But, and that's what Mamie is always saying. But he said, just like his brother said, you know, and you know, the Lord left him here for something. And what I'm hoping he left him here for is to see Mamiya home. That would be all that I need to do. So this is not a time to do nothing backwards, you know, always forward. Always forward. And in March, when I come to Philadelphia, I would like for there to be a better day so the sun would be shining and that more people are there than it was today. And I can't be any happier than what came today. You know, in the bad weather and everything, people still came all the way from New York, all the way from France. You know, it's a humbling thing to walk up on you all. And I was getting ready to do a victory lap today, but I know it's going to go our way.
That's right.
You know, I had said all the prayers I could say, and everything was going to be all right. So they moved us back to 60 days, but I'm going to have a sneak zone. I'm going to ready to do a victory lap there.
That's right.
So we're going to move this case on down the road. And I want to see all y'all in the 27th of March. I love all of y'all.
26th of February.
Mumia Abu-Jamal has dedicated his latest prison radio essay to a father and daughter whose names are now inscribed on the lists of martyrs in the black struggle.
Her name rang with similarity. Erica Garner. One could not say her name without thinking about her fallen father, Eric Garner. Eric Garner, attacked by a cop for selling Lucy's single cigarette on a New York street. Put in a chokehold, which quickly became a death hold. His daughter took up the struggle to demand justice for her father. Erica, whom her mother lovingly called a warrior, fought for her father's memory of a loving man who loved his family and was murdered by an armed agent of the state. The videotape of Eric's killing is as chilling as it is instructive. A tall black man asked cops, "Why are they bothering him?" Cops swarm like locusts, tall, strong. He calmly steps back, repeating his question. A short cop comes from behind, leaps on him, locks his arms in a death choke. Eric falls, his voice hoarse with effort, comes through, "I can't breathe." Erica, fighting a system stingy with justice when it came to black life, suffering from asthma, could not breathe herself, a heart attack, then coma. In Erica Garner, 27 years old, joins her beloved father, Eric, in eternity. They say she died of a heart attack. Seems to me she died of a broken heart from imprisoned nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Since the founding of AFRICOM, the U.S. military command in Africa, in 2008, U.S. troops have spread across the face of the continent. Black Agenda Report editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly says the Congressional Black Caucus has been glaringly silent on the U.S. militarization of Africa. Kimberly was part of a panel discussion on AFRICOM at a Baltimore conference of a coalition against U.S. foreign military bases.
We are here today, as you can see, to talk about U.S. military presence in Africa and about the Africa Command. A few months ago, AFRICOM, although the corporate media didn't use the term very much, was very much in the news because of U.S. troop deaths in the country of Niger. Most of the media didn't even know how to pronounce it, but at any rate. But Niger, it's one of those places that flies under the radar for most Americans, and that's to say they don't even know that it exists until they find out about some American military activity there. And that's what happened in October, after four American soldiers died there. Actually, it was Donald Trump's stupidity and racism which made their deaths a news story. At first, the administration wasn't going to say anything about it. Then he was goaded by someone who suggested, well, he said that Obama didn't call the troops' families and he was going to call their families. But of course, he messed it up. He couldn't even make a decent condolence call to the widow. And that became the news story. The African-American soldier, LaDavid Johnson, he spoke to his widow, and a congresswoman who was a friend of the family overheard the conversation. He was very rude to her. The congresswoman said so. There was all this back and forth. But nobody talked much about Niger, about the fact that there was this huge American presence in this country. There are approximately 800 American soldiers there. There is a drone base there. Two senators, at least two, went on record and stated publicly they had no idea there were so many soldiers in this country, Lindsey Graham and Chuck Schumer. And it's hard to know if they're being honest or possibly that they are that stupid. They just vote for stuff and other people take care of it. But this 21st century scramble for Africa, it's not the first, is a result of several events, all of which can be blamed on the United States. And it's this continent's sad role to play in this perpetual war, the war on terror, as it was called after the attacks of 9/11 in 2001. The U.S. Africa Command was officially formed under President Bush in 2007. And of course, the goal is always fighting terrorism. But AFRICOM makes the United States the de facto controller of African military, some 30 nations. It minimizes the influence, as Ojamu just said, of other countries, like namely China, which is coming into Africa with money, but so the U.S. comes in with guns. And fighting terror is the catch-all phrase for promoting American efforts at hegemony. And Niger's role became even more tragic after 2011. And that's because that was the year in which the United States, Barack Obama, and with NATO, and with the help of Islamist groups, destroyed Libya, murdered the president, and changed everything in that region of the continent. Someone last night was talking about the project for a new American century. One of the essential aspects of that project is destroying secular Arab governments. So first it was Iraq, then it was Libya, then they tried with Syria, and Syria is a big question mark, and thank goodness that it is. But the defeat of Libya's army changed a lot. Their arms were captured by groups such that, and those arms went to other countries. So those arms went to Mali. Boko Haram in Nigeria profited from this American aggression. Boko Haram and Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb and others in the region. But the purpose of American intervention is always to sow chaos. That way the military and their partners in crime get to stay in business. So when they say it was a mistake or it didn't turn out the way they wanted, that's because it was bad PR. not because they really cared. And just a little more about Libya. I cannot talk about Libya without saying, quote, "We came, we saw, he died," unquote. And I cannot see Hillary Clinton's face without thinking of those words when she bragged and she laughed about murdering a president, about destroying a country, about setting off a race war. So when you see anything about Libya, enslavement, organ trafficking, people drowning in the Mediterranean as they try to get to Europe, you must think of her and her boss. So Obama says that he regrets not having a plan, and as I just touched on that a little bit, that's phony. But I want to say something. A few days ago, Donald Trump referred to Haiti and some African countries as shitholes, but Obama called Libya the shit show because of the bad PR. But the issue is never whether things were a mistake or whether they turned out the way some American president claims they wanted things to turn out. We must always be opposed to U.S. interventions. Always. There will always be some rationale of a responsibility to protect. That was the lie that they've come up with in the last few years. But they must always be opposed. And we have to talk about the dimension, the international dimensions of imperialism. I said this was not just a U.S. project, but a NATO project. And the then Prime Minister of the U.K., David Cameron, and the French President Sarkozy, they all ran to Libya and posed for pictures. Hillary Clinton was there as well, getting their policy to fruition. And U.S. policy towards Africa doesn't deviate from a few principles which I've mentioned. First is to subdue any efforts at true independence, that is to say, socialism, to help their NATO partners like France, in this case. Niger is a former French colony, and many other African countries, and keep any other nations like China from gaining influence. And all of those factors come into play there. After the news story about the death of the American soldiers, I wrote in a column in Black Agenda Report, and I called it AFRICOM is the Question. And I was attempting to broaden the level of discourse. So it wasn't just about what Trump said to the widow or, you know, he was rude to the congresswoman. But I wanted to talk about Congress, about the Congressional Black Caucus, about Congresswoman Wilson and her colleagues. Neither she nor anybody else in the Black Caucus had anything worthwhile or useful to say on the issue of Niger, on the issue of the U.S. presence there and in the rest of the continent. Most of them, like the rest of the Democratic Party, voted for this enormous military budget increase. They gave Trump actually more than he originally asked for. So we have to talk about, and this is an action item, they are phony. They are liars. They are traitors. On the one hand, they'll cry about Obamacare and he's taking stuff away. Well, if you increase the military budget by $80 billion, you're taking away a lot from all of us. You're taking away health care. All of the issues we've talked about, the infrastructure, all of the needs that we have in this country cannot be met if you have people voting to increase the military budget the way they did. And I just wanted to say something about this increase in the military budget, $80 billion. That's the total of Russia's military budget, the increase that we had, the 10% increase. That is all of Russia's military spending. So the CBC didn't question the occupation of Niger and Mali and the rest of those countries in the region. There was no pushback. And this policy, Trump's policy, is not that much different from Obama's, which was not that much different from Bush. Actually, Obama's the one who really ratcheted up AFRICOM. The only issue that changes from president to president is the amount of money spent, the degree of intervention, but the story is the same. And I want to talk more about this responsibility to protect and how it has influenced Africa. I mentioned Libya, Nigeria. In 2014, we all know about the young women, the teenage students who were kidnapped by Boko Haram. And then there was a cry to do something. Now, I'm not trying to minimize what happened to those young women, but we have to be careful that when we want to help people and our motives are good and somebody must do something, it cannot be the U.S. military. It can't be the military of France. As soon as that happened, The leaders of five nations in the region, Nigeria, Niger, Chad, Benin, and Cameroon, were all summoned to Paris. Allegedly, they called for the meeting, but they were told to show up there. And the issue was how to increase U.S. and French influence in their region. So Boko Haram actually profited more than anybody. These girls were used as a bargaining chip. They used it to strengthen themselves and other organizations as well. So France controls almost as much as it did in the days when these countries were officially colonies. They do it with money. There's a currency, the CFA, that the French, former French colonies are forced to use. They send their money to Paris. France charges them interest to use their money. Niger has uranium, which is used to power nuclear plants in France. So it's an old story of how stories are kept as shitholes because capitalists in Europe and the U.S. want it to be that way. So I wanted to go back to our representatives in Washington and how little they do, even those who pretend. I said before, the Congressional Black Caucus is mealy-mouthed. They're as bought off as the rest. And I'm going to read briefly a statement they made about Niger. Quote, "Our policy toward Africa should be multidimensional and robust and should utilize all of our foreign policy tools, including diplomacy and development, to their maximum capacity. When defense and diplomacy work in tandem, we will be successful in aiding the second largest continent in the world," unquote. What is that? That's it. Oh, we call for a full investigation into the events, unquote. So that's it. That's all we get from them. So our to-do, my to-do list for you, our homework, collective homework, is to call these people out. We have members of the Congressional Black Caucus like Maxine Waters, who used to be, the caucus was once called the conscience of the Congress. If nobody in Congress said we need to cut the military budget, they would. If nobody talked about leaving Africa alone, they did. But then they became bought off, and people with money did not. There was a time when they were sort of excused, and then they realized, we're like, wait a minute, why are we leaving anybody alone? So now they're as compromised as everyone else. They do what the rest of them do. They do not represent our interests. They act against our interests. About a year ago, when Trump was about to be inaugurated, Congressman John Lewis, who I don't know who made up this term, civil rights icon, but anyway, he was asked if he thought Trump was a legitimate president, and he said no. And he said he's not legitimate because of Russia. Now, he could have said he was not legitimate because of the Electoral College. He could have said he's not legitimate because of voter suppression. He could have said he's not legitimate because black people's votes are stolen, especially in those three states that flipped, but he said nothing like that. So I think it's very, very important that we not allow ourselves to be taken in, especially this week. So much has been made of Trump's comments, and we have to be smart. You don't have to say that's okay. Yes, you can. You should condemn such language. But we have to remember what these other people do. He makes things easier for the Democrats. I feel like they pay him to do it. Every time he opens his mouth and says something racist and stupid, they are let off the hook when they jump into the fray and condemn them. And then many of us don't pay attention to what they do in reality. So thank you all very much.
That was Margaret Kimberly, editor and senior columnist for Black Agenda Report. Also at that conference against U.S. foreign military bases was Maurice Carney of Friends of Congo.
If you look at the map, you can see the Democratic Republic of the Congo and its surrounding countries, which straddle the equator, represents the heart of the African continent. In fact, you can argue that the Congo is the fulcrum on which the African continent swings. And it was central to the carving up of the continent in the 1884-1885 Berlin Conference, where European nations established their spheres of influence in Africa. In fact, not only was it called the Berlin Conference, it was also referred to as the Congo Conference. So U.S. presence in Africa has reached a crescendo due to certain recent events that Margaret mentioned, with the U.S. soldiers being killed in Niger and the controversy that ensued around David Johnson. And this controversy has sort of pierced the veil of the cloud around the continent in the sense that people are more interested and want to know what's going on. U.S. citizens and even people in the peace and anti-war movement. And this struck me as peculiar because here it is that four U.S. soldiers passed in Niger, and because of the stupidity and ignorance of the President of the United States, it became major news. And I said, okay, here it is that from 1996 to the present, an estimated 6 million Congolese have lost their lives as a result to conflict. The United Nations says it's the deadliest conflict in the world since World War II. But I don't recall seeing this kind of an uproar and interest and purchase on the conscience of people about this tremendous loss of life, especially considering that the United States had a role to play in terms of it supporting its client states that triggered the war in Rwanda and Uganda by providing them with arms, equipment, financing. Rwanda has received $1 billion from the United States since 2000. Intelligence. And when some accountability is attempted to be instituted on these countries, the U.S. runs political and diplomatic interference through international bodies like the United Nations. So that struck me. And this window through Niger does not represent the nature or the scope of the intervention that the United States has had on the African continent. As you can see on your fact sheet, for the past decade or so, under the Obama administration, U.S. missions on the continent has increased almost some 2,000%. Within the first year of AFRICOM being formed, October 1st, 2008, where Obama came into office, within that first year, the military presence on the African continent increased some 300%. So we've seen a tremendous expansion of U.S. military presence on the African continent. And this intervention on the part of the U.S. has some history. A few days from now, on January 17th, we'll commemorate the assassination of Patrice Emery Lumumba, Congo's first democratically elected prime minister, who was overthrown by the CIA. It's well documented in a book called The Assassination of Lumumba. The CIA chief of station at the time, Larry Devlin, wrote a book with that title, Congo Chief of Station, where he laid out the rationale for overthrowing this democratically elected leader. Lumumba, arguably one of the most important assassinations in the 20th century, is right along the line of the overthrowing of governments, democratically elected governments, that took place in Chile with Allende, or Iran with Mossadegh, Guzman in Guatemala. This is the line. Often when we talk about the intervention on the part of the U.S., in overthrowing democratically elected leaders, Africa is often left out. But Lumumba falls in that pantheon. And recently, within the last few years, the U.S. State Department published declassified documents dealing with the U.S. covert action on the African continent during that period. And at the time, in the 1960s, the covert action on the part of the United States was the largest in the world against the Congo and Lumumba, the first post-independence country that the United States intervened in. And the chief of station, Larry Devlin, said this: we had to overthrow Lumumba, because if we didn't overthrow Lumumba, not only would we have lost the Congo, we'd have also lost all of Africa. So from the Berlin Conference to the centering of the Congo to the overthrow of Lumumba, we see the centrality of the Congo and its significance to the African continent as a whole. So what you'll notice is that both the conservative forces and revolutionary forces recognize the centrality of the Congo. That's part of the reason why Che went there in 1965, spent 7 months, saw it as a key front in the battle against imperialism, even though The mission was a failure at that time. The Cubans came back later in the 1970s and 80s and helped to defeat the apartheid regime and US CIA in Angola. So there's a book that I would share with you. It's entitled From Congo to Soweto by Henry Jackson, which lays out the US role, intervention in the Congo and Africa in the early 60s. It wasn't just Lumumba that they overthrew. Nefa mentioned earlier in 66 with the coup in Ghana and the overthrow of Kwame Nkrumah, the US was involved. What you'll notice is that the US has a pattern on the African continent being anti-liberation, right? They were against the frontline states in southern Africa. I shared with you the case in Angola where the CIA was involved and in cahoots with the apartheid state and fighting in the Angolan Civil War. They were against liberation heroes. It was the United States that provided the information that resulted in the arrest of Nelson Mandela. It was the United States that put Nelson Mandela on the U.S. terrorist list. Mandela and the ANC. And even after Mandela got out of jail, it wasn't until 2008, in an attempt to see that he didn't reach his 90th birthday or to remove him from the terrorist list before he passed. That's when he got taken off the U.S. terrorist list. So if you look at the U.S. engagement on the African continent, it's been on the wrong side of history. It hasn't been on the side of democracy, hasn't been on the side of liberation, hasn't been on the side of self-determination. So AFRICOM represents the continuation of this. Now, the destructive role of the United States on the African continent reaches its most insidious level in the Congo, in that the United States supported its client states, its allies, in the triggering of what I shared with you earlier was the deadliest conflict in the world since World War II. And in 1998, when Bill Clinton traveled to the African continent, they had a meeting in Entebbe, in Uganda. And out of this meeting came what is known as the Entebbe Principles. And the Entebbe Principles really draw from the Washington Consensus. The Washington Consensus has about 10 points. It's firmly ensconced in the neoliberal framework where the U.S., forces, the U.S. Institutions like the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, they call on African nations to privatize their state assets, invest in cash crops as opposed to subsidies for agriculture, focus more on deregulation, private sector, divest from health, education, and so forth. So a number of leaders at the time, you had figures such as Paul Kagame of Rwanda and Yoweri Museveni of Uganda and Meles Zenawi of Ethiopia, all being embraced around the Entebbe Principles and being championed as the new breed of African leaders, new Pan-Africanists. You had figures like, at the time, Susan Rice was the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, and Madeleine Albright was the Secretary of State. And they held up these leaders as the Renaissance leaders of Africa. You know what they had in common, in addition to embracing the Washington Consensus and neoliberal principles? They've all invaded other countries. They're authoritarian figures. They got the power through the barrel of a gun. They have the blood of millions of Africans on their hands. So what the U.S. does is it takes these figures who are sociopaths and it brings them here to us and present them as new breed of African leaders. Right? And they utilize their experts in crushing their population. And this is where the support of AFRICOM really works against the interests of the masses of Africans. Because these sociopaths are backed up by the U.S. military. They're financed to the hilt with equipment and intelligence in the works. And they use it to crush the progressive social forces inside the country. The rationale for AFRICOM, and the Bush administration was shrewd in laying this out, was for going to build wells, provide humanitarian support, provide human rights training. Now, we know of all the entities in the world, the U.S. military is the least qualified to provide humanitarian training. And they did that in a shrewd way because they put at the head of AFRICOM a homegrown figure from right here in Baltimore. Grew up in Baltimore. Kip Ward. Graduated from Morgan, a black man. And he was the face of AFRICOM. The advancement, the vertical advancement of African Americans. So made it even harder for you to, made it seem even more fuzzy, so to speak. But the reason why they can able to get away with this and do what they do in Africa, a main reason, not the only reason, but a significant reason nonetheless. And we believe that it comes out of this Hegelian notion of Africa, right? Because Hegel, in his philosophy of history, argued that Africa had no history, right? He said that there were no great wars fought in Africa. No great empires rose and fell like other places. And he even did the intellectual gymnastics of removing North Africa, Egypt, and Northern Africa from Africa as a whole, right? And he said that of Africa, he said it laid beyond the day of history, enveloped in the dark mantle of night. That's what Hegel said. And it's because of this notion that we have of the African continent as dark, with figures that are perpetually deemed to internecine tribal warfare, irredeemable souls, right? The Joseph Conrad's heart of darkness, even though he wasn't talking about Africans when he talked about the heart of darkness, he was talking about the hearts of those colonizers, those who were in service to King Leopold II. So it's this notion that allows us to first get a sense of Africa because of four U.S. soldiers, and not because millions of lives have been lost, right? It could have happened. Millions of lives have lost anywhere else in the world. There'd be international outcry. People want to know, how do we stop this? How do we bring this to an end? Especially considering that the modern tools that we use, the coltan and the cobalt, is vital to the functioning of our cell phones and the electric cars that we all drive to express ourselves and support the green energy or green technology, where Congo is the number one source of cobalt in the world. So here it is that we get these resources to advance our modern society, yet the people who are being crushed as a result of their sitting on that $24 trillion worth of natural wealth are silent. There's not a peep about them. Even if we're concerned about climate change, where the Congo Basin is a part of the second largest rainforest in the world and vital to the fight against climate change, an issue that we all say that we're concerned about. But what about the people who live there? So the first thing we can do is to radically transform the way we view Africa. Instead of looking it through the lens and the prism of charity, we need to look at Africa through the prism of justice. And if we do that, then we summon Dr. King, where he said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So that's the first thing that we can do in terms of action, and restructure the way we look at the African continent and people of African ancestry. The second is for us to challenge these sociopaths when they come here. They come to our university campuses. They're at Harvard. They're at Yale. They go to Brandeis, Paul Kagame. They commit crimes in Africa, and they come here to cleanse those crimes on the international level. So each and every one of us can do that. We encourage you to sign up on our email list. You can go to Black Alliance for Peace for sure. Certainly on friendsofthecongo.org and sign up on the email list. We will let you know when it's time to take action when these guys come here so we can challenge them. Third and final, there are social movements taking place on the African continent, particularly among the youth. And it's vital that we stand in solidarity with them. It's critical that we support their efforts, not just solely out of solidarity, but out of self-interest. We can learn a lot from their movements. I know people talk about the Arab Spring, but let me tell you this. You know, first of all, Tunisia is in Africa. Tunisia is a part of the African continent. And Africa has a rich tradition of resistance, of overthrowing colonialism, only to be come back up on by the French and the U.S. in a violent escapade across the continent to rid the continent of the liberation leaders like Lumumba and Nkrumah and others, and impose the puppets that we see today. So supporting the youth movements, the social justice movements on the African continent, today we see Togo, for example, rising up, trying to get rid of a 50-year dynasty in Ayedema. And you know what happened during their rise up? The foray, the president of Togo, he had organized an Israel-Africa summit in Togo because the Israelis are trying to get a stronger footprint on the African continent to get support. But because there was a resistance movement in Togo, they had to cancel that. We'll wrap up right there. That's the third and final one of solidarity and support of movements on the African continent. Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.